opportunity first to thank Catherine and Walter and all the organizing committee for the invitation to participate in the thematic program of PDEs this year, and also for the invitation to give this colloquium. So what I'm going to talk about today, it's a problem that comes from atomic physics, from the Schrödinger operator type things, and it has some connections with geometry. And I would like to point out these connections with geometry. The problem is still open, and from time to time it's driving me crazy. The problem at the very end, the problem seems to be a very easy problem. Nevertheless, you will see it's very complicated. All I am going to say today is joint work with Michael Loss from the from Georgia Tech. So first, I will say a few things about the Lip-Turing inequalities. The Lip-Turing inequalities started in 1975 with the work of Lip and Turing on the stability of matter. That matter is stable, it means that if you have a system of m particles and you compute the energy of this system, then the energy is extensive. I mean, the energy is bounded from below by a constant times the number of particles, so it will not implode. So that's what we call the stability of matter, or at least one sort of stability. And the stability of matter for regular matter, I mean for matter described by a non-relativistic Schrödinger equation, was proven in a series of two papers by Dyson and Lenard at the end of the 60s. And those papers are very ingenious. It's a long sequence of very ingenious inequalities, and at the very end they prove this stability. The constant that they get for the quotient between the energy and the number of particles is not very good, but the argument, it was the first time it was proven, and the arguments were very nice. Later on, in 1975, Lieb and Turing reproved the stability of matter, and they got a much better estimate for the energy per particle. And there are two main ingredients in the proof of the stability of matter of Lieb and Turing. The main ingredients are, one is coming from physics, and the other one is coming from math. The one from coming from physics is that Thomas Fermi, which is a density functional model, an approximation to the real description of matter, is a very good approximation. And in Thomas Fermi, it was proven by Edward Teller in 1962. In Thomas Fermi, there are no molecules. I mean, atoms prefer to stay apart. And if you you compare the energy of a molecule with the energy of two atoms separated, the energy of the atoms together is bigger. So in Thomas Fermi, this is Teller's theorem, and it was proven in 62, long after Thomas Fermi was introduced in the 20s. And it says that atoms really don't like to be together. And in fact, in the real matter, it's very bulky. I mean, atoms are very far apart. Most of the stuff in the middle is, it's empty. And this is one of the remnants of Thomas Fermi being a good approximation. And this is the physics ingredient that Lieb and Turing introduced in their paper of 75. The fact that Thomas Fermi is a good approximation. And in order to get, in order to use Thomas Fermi, they needed to have a lower bound for the energy of an atom described by quantum mechanics. And they used a mathematical tool, which is the Lip-Turing inequalities. I mean, inequalities that connect sums of powers of eigenvalues with the potential. We don't need to know the exact proof of Lieb and Turing, but I'm going to tell you what the Lieb-Turing inequalities are in abstract now. You can check the main properties of the the main results related to the Lieb-Turing inequalities in an article by Elliot Lieb in the Encyclopedia of Mathematics of year 2000, and there are many other sources. So consider the Schrödinger Hamiltonian minus Laplacian plus B, where B is a say, a negative potential that goes to zero to infinity, and you, and this is defined on L2 of Rn. N is the number of dimensions. And let me call E1, E2, etc., the negative eigenvalues of the Hamiltonian. And so the Lipp-Turing inequality says that the sum of this of the absolute values to the power gamma of these things are bounded from above by these integrals of the negative part of the potential. And these are valid in any, for different exponents gamma here, they are valid in different dimensions. And they are known to hold for, in dimension one, for gamma bigger or equal to a half here, in dimension two, for any strictly positive gamma, and for dimension bigger or equal to three, for any gamma positive or zero here. These inequalities, they date back to 75, to the paper of Lieb and Turing, and in recent years there have been lots of results connected to these inequalities. In particular, the case, the fact that these inequalities hold for gamma equal a half and dimension one was only established by in 1996 by Timo Beidel. It wasn't known to it, not even whether it was true or not. The case gamma equals zero and dimension three or bigger, it's called the Swyko-Lieb-Rosenblum bound, and I mean it gives you a bound on the number of eigenvalues in terms of the integrals of the potential. And let me introduce now, the problem here, from the point of view of math, the problem, I mean, these are known to hold for this range of values of gammas and n. But the problem from the point of view of math is to determine the sharpest constant here, and the sharp constant L gamma n for as a function of gamma and n. And in order to discuss the sharp constant, I will first introduce what are called the classical or semi-classical constant here. If you follow the Planck's dictum and try to approximate the sum of the powers of the eigenvalues by an integral in phase space, you will replace this quantity here by, h bar here is 1, by this quantity there. And this is an integral in phase space. You can integrate in the momentum here, and you are going to end up with an inequality of this sort. And in this case, you can compute precisely the value of these constants, and these are called the classical or semi-classical constants. And they are given in terms of a beta function, in terms of gamma functions. Yeah. And one can, since this is the semi-classical estimate, and it should be valid for small values of h, and that implies that the sharp constant here in the Lipp-Turing problem cannot be lower than the classical inequality. N? No, N is finite here. N is the dimension. H going to zero, right? Yeah. But I'm not going to worry about H going to zero. I'm just saying that if you use semi-classics, if you use the H going to zero limit, then you can prove immediately that this cannot be violated. That's all. The dimension here is fixed. It's 1, 2, 3, etc. So anyway, because of this bound, it is convenient to define this quotient between L, the real sharp estimate, and the classical value given by this quantity here. Because of that, R is always not bigger or equal to 1. In 1978, Michael Eisenman and Elliot Leeb, they proved that R is a decreasing function of gamma. If you use that, this theorem of Michael Eisenman, and a result that was proven in the original paper of Lieb and Turing, they proved that the sharp constant for in dimension one and for exponent gamma equal to c half is precisely the semi-classical constant. So if you combine these two results, then and the fact that R is never less than 1, then you have that for any exponent bigger than 3 half, the sharp constant are going to be the semi-classical values. I mean, the classical values. In dimension higher, in dimension bigger than one, it was proven only in 2000, the same result. I mean, for any exponent, for any dimension bigger than one, and for any exponent bigger than three, bigger or equal than 3/2, then the sharp constant are the semi-classical constant. So everything is well established from gamma equal to 3/2 on, right? On the other side, when gamma is equal to 1/2 in dimension one, Hundermark, Lieb, and Thomas in 98, they proved that the sharp constant is equal to 1/2, and this is bigger than the classical, strictly bigger than the classical constant. Also, Helfer and Robert, Didier Robert, they proved that for any gamma less than 1 and m bigger or equal to 1, then you have this strict inequality between the sharp constant and the classical thing. So there is a gap. I'm going to concentrate now in dimension 1. And in one can also treat the problem in higher dimension, but this is already hard enough. So there is a gap. In what concerns the sharp values of the constants in the Lipp-Thierry inequalities for exponents between 1/2 and 3/2. So from 3/2 on, we know what the answer is. It's just a semi-classical constant. At 1/2, we know what the constant is. And in between, we don't know. However, in the paper of 75, in the paper of 76, in honor of Valentin Bergman, Lieb and Thierry, they had a conjecture that's still open and that's still open now. And the conjecture says, if you want to find the sharp values of the constant in front of the Lipp-Thierry problem, you should just restrict yourself to potentials that have only one bound state. And among the class of potentials that only have one bound state, you can compute exactly what this is. I will tell you how to do it in a minute. And the constant turns out to be this. Well, it looks very crazy, but it's very easy to estimate in terms of gamma functions and all that. So the Lipp-Thierry conjecture that was postulated in 76 is this one. I mean, prove that these are the sharp constants for any gamma between 1/2 and 3/2. The best constant so far, well, modulo a very important paper that was overseen here. I will tell you that at the very end. But modulo that paper that I will tell you at the end, the best constant to date for different exponents, different dimensions, and all that, they are given in this paper by Hundermark, Laptev, and Beidel in Invenciones of 2000. So, first of all, I'm going to tell you, well, the talk now is to relate this problem, I mean, how to find the sharp constant for the Lipp-Thierry conjecture in dimension one for this exponent to a problem, not even for any gamma. I will do it just for gamma equal one, which is interesting enough. And we will connect it to a problem in geometry that it's very appealing. Nevertheless, it seems to be hard too, even though it's very easy to state. So the origin of this connection is the following. If we believe the conjecture of Lieb and Thierry, we should only concentrate in potentials on just considering the lowest eigenvalue of the potential and trying to optimize the powers of these eigenvalues in terms of the integrals of the potential. And instead of concentrating in sums of eigenvalues, just consider the first eigenvalue. And that problem was considered by Joe Keller in 61. The reason he came up with this problem is that he was working on problems of finding the shape of the strongest column. And if you try to, and this is a very classical problem in optimization, there are lots of discussion even up today. And at that time, Joe Keller was working on that problem, and that, if you try to study the shape of the strongest column, you end up with an eigenvalue problem of similar type. I mean, it's not exactly the same. And probably that's why he considered this problem. I mean, it was sort of like in a related vein as the shape of the strongest column. And using the direct calculus of variation, he proved the following bound, where L1, 1 gamma, the one means just consider potentials with one bound state, and this is the value that I gave you before in the previous transparency. Well, problems of this sort have been considered by several people. The list that I'm going to give you is here is by no means complete. There is a huge literature in maximizing lambda 1, lambda 1 plus lambda 2, all sorts of combinations and in different settings. If you want to have Evans Harrell, Mark Ashwell, and Evans Harrell, Chris Benevitz, and Belling, and the latest I've seen in this sort of literature is this long paper by Belling that appeared like 2 years ago. It has all different connections. So what I'm going to tell you now is a very trivial proof of the Joe Keller result without appealing to the calculus variations at all. I mean, it's going to be completely algebraic. And the reason I give it to you is that through this proof is that we started making the connection with the geometry problem in the case of two eigenvalues. So let's go to the proof of the Keller bound. So we have a one-dimensional Schrödinger operator. I will call the potential minus B, so B is positive. And the first eigenvalue, I'm going to call it minus lambda 1. So lambda 1 is positive here. This is defined in the full line. We're looking for normalized solutions. Well, if you multiply this equation by U1, surely enough you have that. And now you can have a simple estimate, or I mean a point-wise estimate between the potential and U1. This has been done by lots of people in connection with this problem. So this is point-wise bound on VU1 square. For any positive k, you have this bound. You introduce it here. And so you are going to have what you want, more or less, plus, I mean, this I'm going to do it first for gamma equal 1, then I'll tell you how to do it for any other gamma. So you are going to have the first two things are exactly what you want, and then you have some remainder there. However, if U1, if the integral of U1 is 1, you have this inequality here. And so if you choose k appropriately, then you are going to have the right bound. And to the value of k is just 4 over c square root of 3 pi. And then if you believe that inequality, then you have this bound, which is one of the results of Keller, right? And, well, I'm going to trivialize the problem even further, and I'm going to give you a proof of this inequality, which doesn't, I mean, you can prove this in several different ways. You can use calculus of variations or write the Euler equations, solve it, etc. But I'm going to tell you a proof of this, which is totally algebraic. And so what we're going to do is the following. I'm going to make a change of variables. And so instead of using x goes from minus infinity to infinity, then choose just goes from x to s. S is the new variable. It's the integral from minus infinity to x of u1 squared. Since u1 is normalized, then this s is going from 0 to 1. So this transformation transforms the line into the unit interval. And this is the Jacobian. So if you use this transformation, then the integral of u1 to the 6th is just u1 fourth times u1 squared. u1 squared times dx is just dx. So you have that expression there. And you can compute also the integral of the derivative squared, and that's going to give you that. And now, so the inequality you wanted to prove is an inequality that relates this integral here with this power 6 here. And now, what we really end up, if you do this transformation, you end up having something of power 4 here and power 4 there, the same power. And in fact, if you define w to be u1 squared, then this integral becomes just the integral of w squared. This integral becomes the integral of w dot squared. And the integral the inequality that you were looking to prove, reduces just to the fact that the first Dirichlet eigenvalue of the interval 0, 1 is just pi squared. So that makes it completely trivial, right? I mean, so this is well known. Well, you can, in fact, you can undo the, I mean, you know what the solution of this problem is, right? The solution of this, I mean, the function that gives you equal sign here is just sine pi s. And you can undo your steps and compute what is the solution to the U1 that has equality in the previous inequality, and that's going to be 1 over cos squared or something like that. You can compute it very easily. Okay, suppose you want to do now all the other exponents for the Kehle's problem. So if you want to do the other exponents, what you do is the following. You start again with the same Schrödinger equation, negative potential, negative eigenvalue. You only consider the first eigenvalue. You multiply by U1 and integrate. And then you use Hilbert's inequality to have that. And so in this way, you separate the dependence on V and the dependence on U. And now if you are able to, U is normalized. And if you are able to prove the following inequality between U prime and U, then you are done. I mean, you can separate this in this way. And then soon enough, you get what you want. And so modulo proving this inequality, then you are done with the Kehle's problem. And this inequality involves some constant here that you have to determine. And, well, we knew that for gamma equal 1, this inequality is totally trivial. It reduces to the problem of the first Dirichlet eigenvalue of the interval 0, 1. Well, we're not going to be that lucky for any other gamma. I mean, if you have gamma different from 1. Excuse me? This one is, yes, this should be gamma, yeah. This should be L1 gamma, right? I mean, N is the dimension, and gamma is, well, maybe I have it mixed there. And 1 refers to the fact that you have only one bound state. Yeah. Thank you very much. So anyway, so modulo, well, they are not independent, right? If you want to maximize here, you see, when you are doing that, and you use Hilbert's inequality, I mean, you use Hilbert's inequality here, right? In order to have equality here, the potential and U have to be connected. And so, and then, from here, you are going to know what the U that saturates this inequality is going to be. You go to the case of equality in the Hilbert's inequality, and you are going to have the potential that maximizes that, right? So that's the way. I mean, here, this is independent of the potential. Once you have equality here, you go back here, and you have your favorite, I mean, you have the potential that's going to give you the sharp constant in the electron. So I should have said that. But So anyway, that's the step, right? So here you have total independence, but then you have to connect V with the U. So thank you very much. I mean, that's crucial. I mean, and then that gives you the potential. Not only you have the sharp constant for the Kehle's problem, but also you have the potential that produces a sharp constant. Right? So anyway, as I said before, if you go for gamma different than 1, we're not going to be that lucky as before. But then, nevertheless, this is going to be rather simple. Since U is normalized to be the integral of L2 to be 1, L2 integral of U to be 1, then you use the same change of variables as before. So we go from x to s. S is just minus infinity to x for that. And also you change the dependent variable. Instead of using u, you use w, which is u squared. And then you are going to have this inequality is going to read something like that. And this is just a Sobolev type inequality. And you can characterize the sharp constant here in terms of this quotient. You can use the Euler equation, and this is an easy problem in mechanics. I mean, you have a particle moving with this force, you're going to have a particle moving with this potential here, and then you can compute the solution to this problem very easily. So it's not that simple. I mean, it's not like, I mean, the case gamma equal 1 corresponds to the fact that you have a harmonic oscillator here. if you have gamma different from one, it's a little bit more complicated, but it's, nevertheless, everything is computable and in simple terms. So anyway, let me go now to the problem that we're interested in, right? I mean, trying to prove the Lip-Turing conjecture. As I said, I mean, the problem is still open. I'm not going to prove it. So the only thing I'm going to do is to make a connection with the problem in geometry in the plane. So if we want to prove the Lip-Turing conjecture that says that if you want to maximize lambda 1 when... We're going to stick to gamma equal 1 now and to dimension 1. And the Lip-Turing, in that case, it would say that if you want to maximize lambda 1 subject to the integral of b to the 3/2 to be fixed, then you should just... not lambda 1, but the sum of the eigenvalues to be maximized, then you should just restrict to potentials that have only one bound state. This is what we want to prove. So suppose that we have a potential that has two bound states, and I want to prove that I cannot do any better than just the result that I would get with a potential having only one bound state. So we assume that there are at least two. So you have two eigenvalues and two eigenfunctions which are orthonormal. I mean, they are orthogonal and normalized, right? And then you start playing the same tricks, I mean, the same games as before. So you multiply, and I didn't write the corresponding Schrödinger equation, but imagine you have minus u 1/2 plus minus vu equal lambda 1 u, etc. You multiply by u 1 and integrate. So this is the integrated version of the Schrödinger equation. So now you sum these two eigenvalues, and you have something like that, and then you use the same sort of pointwise estimate. So you use v times u 1 squared plus u 2 squared. You have an upper bound in terms of the potential alone and in terms of the U1 and U2 square. So you plug it in here, and you are going to have... you have separated the dependence on U1 and U2 and the dependence on the potential. And if you want to prove the Lip-Turing conjecture for gamma equal 1, n equal 1, it would be enough to prove that this quantity here is bigger than pi squared over 4 times that, which is the value that we were getting before when you only had one eigenfunction. No U2 here, no U2 here. Right? And remember that U1 and U2 are orthonormal. I mean, U1 is orthogonal to U2, and U1 and U2 are normalized. So to prove the Lip-Turing inequality for this reduced case, I mean, we're just considering two eigenvalues. I mean, we're not even considering the whole problem of n eigenvalues. I'll tell you some words about that later, but just two eigenvalues and say we cannot do better with two than what we were doing already with one. So in order to do that, you just need to prove this inequality for any pair of functions that are orthogonal and orthonormal, normalized. Yeah? Yeah.
So it makes me think that I want to make two solid bound potentials with two wells each with a bound state, separately, very, very far from the bound state, very, very close together. And somehow you can't do better than twice the.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought this. Surely, yeah. I'm very glad you brought this thing here. I mean, in the paper of 76 of Lieb and Turing, right, it was a time when the people from KdV equation, soliton stuff was booming, right? I mean, there were lots of things. And the proof... Surely, yeah. Yeah, surely. So all these things combined, right, all these things together, The proof of Lieb and Turing that L3 half was equal to L3 half classical uses the KdV equation, right? And it uses the conservation laws, and it uses the trace formulas, and all the stuff that was coming from KdV. I mean, the connection from KdV and the Schrödinger equation. So that was the. I mean, nowadays there are lots of different proofs. I mean, I mean, like 2 years ago, we wrote a paper with Michael Loss with a different proof, which is also has some connection with the problem, because I mean, we were using commutation methods that were also an important tool for the people in inverse scattering problems and all the KdV sort of things, right? So, but nowadays there are tons of different proofs of that. But I'm very glad that you brought this thing here, because I mean, the proof of the fact that the L3 half classical, L3 half 1 is equal to L3 half classical. The first proof was given in terms of the connection of the Schrödinger equation and the KdV problem. And in fact, I mean, you are right. I mean, the solutions that are going to give you the maximum are just the solenoid things separated. Yeah. So that's something very important to have in mind. I mean, in this problem. Yeah. Surely, in that case, it's 1 over cos squared or something, yeah. Well, with a different constant, though. I mean, the coupling constant is different, but it's the same sort of like a solenoid square, yeah. The coupling constant is different, but the form is the same. But in that case, you can solve it completely. I mean, it's, so anyway, I'm glad you wrote that thing. But so anyway, the problem, if you really want to prove the Lipkin conjecture in this reduced way, I mean, just having two eigenvalues, it's just enough to prove that. I mean, that looks simple enough, but it's pretty hard. And remember, the important thing here is that U1 and U2 are orthonormal. And so if they are not, then you can lower this one. So anyway, we go with the schema that we had devised before, and we try to see what it, I mean, in the Keller case, it was trivializing the whole problem, so we had some hopes that it could do something here. So we make a similar change of variables. Now you have these two functions, and we're going to go from X to S. S is just one half of that. And S is going to move from 0 to 1. Maybe, well, we have changed, I mean, well, I'll change the limits later on, but it's not important here. So let me stick to that. So define S to be that, and then S is going to be from 0 to 1. And that's taking care of the fact that U1 and U2 are, well, that's not taking care of everything, but we're using the fact that U1 and U2 are normalized to say that S goes from 0 to 1. Now, go to polar coordinates. So you say U1 is rho cosine theta, and U2 is rho sine theta. And so U1 squared plus U2 squared is going to be rho squared, and this thing here is going to be just that. So the left side of the inequality that I showed you in the previous transparencies in terms of this rho is going to be given by that, where I made a change of independent variable here from x to s. And the right side is going to change by that, right? So, and now we're going to do the same change of dependent variable as before, and we're going to go to the double, to the square function, right? And since we are polar here, going square means we're going to take r to be rho square, and the angle is going to be twice the angle. And in terms of these quantities, these new quantities, r, phi, right, and the independent variable s, the inequality that we were supposed to be proven, it's written in these terms, right? I mean, this inequality between U1 and U2, U1 prime, U2 prime, just reduces to this quantity here, which looks very innocent. I mean, and, well, we have to worry about the constraints, right? There were constraints coming from the fact that U1 and U2 were orthonormal. So we have to impose that the integral of U1 squared is 1, the integral of U2 squared is 1, and that the integral of U1 to U2 is 0. Well, we already took into account part of this, right? I mean, we already took care of the integral of U1 squared plus U2 squared from the fact that S is running from 0 to 1. So we can just take care of the difference here. So anyway, if you write U1 and U2 in terms of r and phi, then these conditions here, they reduce to this condition here. This is cosine 5 and sine 5 integrated from 0 to 1 integrated from 0 to 1. And this is the important thing to make the connection with geometry, right? So what we would like to prove is that this quotient is never below 4 pi squared whenever phi is restricted to satisfy these 5 conditions here, right? Well, of course, if you change the scale here, if you go from 0 to 2 pi, then this is going to reduce accordingly. And so probably I will change the normalization later on. But anyway, you want to minimize this quantity subject to these side constraints. And what these side constraints mean is the following. Well, there are two ways of viewing that, but consider a closed curve in the plane. With positive curvature, let's say an oval, and let's draw the tangent vector here, t, right? And let me call phi to be the angle that the tangent vector makes with some fixed direction in the plane. So if you have a closed curve, right, t is going to be just drds, r is the position vector of a point in the curve, and if you go around the curve, if you integrate, if you interpret S to be arc length, and if you integrate this along the curve, then the integral of TdS has to be 0. And you see, if you, T is a unit tangent vector, and this T is given by the components in the Cartesian coordinates here, just cosine 5 and sine 5, and the fact that you have a closed curve is totally equivalent to the constraint that we had before. So we had the integral of cosine phi, the integral of sine phi equal to 0. So we have changed the problem to the following problem, right? Let me go back here, and then I will. So now you can interpret this in the following way. If you go to the picture that I was drawing before, phi is just the angle that the tangent vector makes with a fixed direction. So phi dot is nothing else than the curvature. So what you are really looking at here is a Schrödinger operator, the expectation value of the Schrödinger operator, where the potential is given by the... it's the Schrödinger operator of a closed curve, where the potential is just curvature squared. And that problem has been considered by many people because of different reasons. So let me consider now a more general problem. Let me consider the following Hamiltonian, the following operator. This is minus d2 ds2 plus g times kappa squared, where g is a coupling constant. We're really interested in g equal 1. That's our problem, right? I mean, so that's the connection with, it's not our, but this is the connection with the Lipp-Tyrwhen problem in gamma equal 1. So consider that Hamiltonian in a closed curve, let's say with positive curvature. Here I didn't make it a positive curvature. But let's say we want to consider that on a closed curve of length 1 with positive curvature, and we're interested in trying to determine the bottom of the spectrum, the lowest eigenvalue here. Well, this problem, as I said before, has been considered for different reasons, nothing to do with Lipp-Tyrwhen, by many people. In particular, Pavel Exner, Evans Harran, and Michael Loss in 98, they proved the following. They proved that if the coupling constant here is between 0 and 1 quarter, then the circle, I mean, you are considering here this as a function of a curve and a coupling constant. So for if the coupling constant is between 0 and 1 quarter, the circle will minimize the fundamental eigenvalue. And in that case, we can compute it exactly, right? They also proved that if g is above 1, we're interested in g equal 1 exactly, then the circle doesn't minimize lambda 1. They have other figures that will minimize it. But the gap, I mean, between a quarter and 1, the whole problem is open. I mean, we don't know what the curve that minimizes this thing is in when g is between a quarter and 1. And we don't know the minimum value. There are lots of conjectures, but we don't know. I'll give you some results about this later, and for the case g equal 1, which is the interesting case for us. I mean, for there is another picture. There is another interpretation of this problem that could be useful if we want to prove the Lee Turing thing for gamma equal one, the Lee Turing inequality for gamma equal one. So instead of interpreting S as a fine length, we can interpret it as time, and you can use polar. I mean, sorry, we can go back to the Cartesian coordinates here, and instead of using r and phi, use x equal r cosine phi and y r sine phi, and the Lee Turing inequality would be equivalent to prove this thing here, this quotient. Well, this is the velocity square, right? This quotient here is never less than 4 pi square. Whenever you satisfy, and here the constraints have a crazy looking way, this is the constraint here. I mean, the integral of x divided by square root of x square plus y square, if you go from time s to from 0 to 1, then this is 0, and also that's 0. And in, well, this picture can, I mean, the previous picture cannot be generalized to the case when you have n eigenvalues, but if you are in this picture, you can generalize it very easily to the case of n eigenvalues. I mean, you just add as many terms as eigenvalues you had in the previous equation, in the original Lee Turing problem. So you have x1 squared plus x2 squared, etc., and the equivalent thing here. And then you are going to have a constraint that looks like that. I mean, R is going to be a vector, and this is just the integral of the unit vector from time 0 to 1 is always 0. These constraints are pretty hard to deal with. If instead of this constraint you would have the same but without the square root here, then this inequality is trivial. It's just, in fact, the integral of x dot square would be bigger or equal than 4 pi square integral of x square independently, and integral of y dot square would be bigger than that, because this would just be telling you that x is orthogonal to the constants and y would be orthogonal to the constant. So if you didn't have this crazy square root there, everything would be very easy. Unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, I mean, the problem is more interesting, but unfortunately we have this square root there. And you can change these constraints, and you can study the sort of numerically dependence on these constraints, and there are lots of interesting stuff coming from that problem also. So anyway, now I'm going to tell you two small results about the Lee Turing problem and this operator that could be of interest in the proof. So the first thing that I'm going to tell you now is an estimate on the lowest eigenvalue of this operator, which is the operator that we are interested in. This is the H for the Hamiltonian on the closed curve when the coupling constant is equal to 1. And I'm going to tell you how to prove that this is always no less than a half. And in fact, remember, what we would really want to prove is that this is greater or equal to 1. So we're failing here. I mean, this is not the sharp constant. But nevertheless, this is going to give you better values for the Lee Turing constant than values that have been obtained so far. So maybe there's a chance that this method would eventually work. Okay, so how do you prove this half here? Well, you just use Fourier analysis. Remember, we have to, if we use the expectation value of this Hamiltonian, what we would really like to do, here I change the length, I should have said that before. I mean, if S goes from 0 to 1, this constant should be pi square over 4, S pi square over 4. If S goes from 0 to 2 pi, this would be 1. We change from time to time, in desperation, but so here I'm going to say from 0 to 2 pi, and okay, I hope that doesn't mess things up. So anyway, we need to estimate that quantity there. So how do you estimate? We need an estimate from below of this quantity here divided by the integral of r squared, or you would fix the r to be normalized and to be 1. So we need to find a lower bound of that quantity when R is normalized, and kappa here is just theta dot, or 5 dot in the previous notation. And we would like to do this for among all possible closed curves, right? And in terms of theta, this is what I called phi before. In terms of theta, the fact that the curve is closed is just given by that. I mean, EI theta in polar, I mean, if you write this using Euler's formula, this is just the integral of cosine theta and sine theta, which are the fact the integral of cosine theta has to be zero when you go around the curve. The fact that the theta is just the angle that the tangent vector forms with a given direction. So you want to minimize that or find lower bound to that subject to this normalization for R and using the fact that the curve is closed. So now you can write this, you can go back and write this quantity as in terms using complex variables in terms of that. I mean, R EI theta, you take the derivative of that with respect to S, you take the mod square, and that's going to be precisely that, right? And now we're going to use Fourier series to express RI theta. So RI theta, this is a periodic function of period 2 pi, not 1 as before, we changed the period, but and we use Fourier series, and we write it in that way. So this quantity here is very simple in terms of the Fourier coefficient. This is just n squared times mod Cn squared. So we need to estimate that. And this sum can be bound from below by the sum of the Cn squared. I mean, when n is zero, this doesn't give a contribution. So this is bounded from below by the sum of the Cn squared from n with n different from zero. And since the R squared is normalized, the sum of the Cn squared is 1. So you can write this in terms of C0 squared, C0, as 1 minus C0 squared. So the only thing that, I mean, in order to get this a half, we need to bound to have a bound on C0. So C0, C0 is the first Fourier, I mean, the zero's Fourier coefficient. So C0 is given in terms of the function that we were expressing in terms of Fourier series by that. And mod C0 is going to be bound by that quantity there, right, which where I'm going to call D. So this C naught is always less or equal than this quantity D. Now we're going to use the closure condition. So the closure condition says that the integral of EI theta is zero when you go around the curve. So because of that, you realize that EI theta is orthogonal to the constant. I mean, the fact that this is the closure condition now says that this is orthogonal to the constant. And so you have just by the Bessel's inequality, I mean, the components of R along the constants and along the EI theta, because of Bessel's inequality, you have this inequality, C0 squared plus D squared is less or equal to 1. Remember that R is normalized. So on the one hand, you have C0 is less than D. On the other hand, C0 squared is less or equal than 1 minus D squared. So C0 squared is less or equal than the minimum of that quantity. So, and that quantity is just less or equal to a half. You plug it in here, and then you get this bound on the energy. So this is the best thing we can do so far. And in when S is going from 0 to 2 pi, we would really like to prove that E is bigger or equal to 1. So the hope is to prove a 1 here, not a half. Yeah, but this is the best we have done so far. If the Lipp-Thierry conjecture holds, as I said before, E should be greater or equal to 1. And there is a whole family of curves, and that's what makes the problem more complicated. You have lack of compactness if you want to prove, you want to use the calculus of variation. There is a whole family of maximizers, and the whole family is described here. I mean, R, the eigenfunction, is given by that in terms of S, and the curvature is given by that. A and B are constant that are related since R is normalized. You need to do that. So if, I mean, you can compute precisely the value of the energy for all these curves, and that's of the lowest eigenvalue, and this is going to be precisely 1. But we don't know whether this is the real minimizer. Well, to finish, I would like to have to present you two different last things here. First, I would like to comment on, I would like to present you a paper of Eden, a very short proof of the best bound so far for the for this inequality, which is due to Eden and Foyas. And unfortunately, this has been oversight overlooked at this paper. And if you look at the paper of Hundermark, Lapte, Van Bijl, they don't even mention, and this is the best result so far. So I should say a few words about the about this inequality, how to prove it, and also why it fails, but it doesn't give you the sharp constant. So anyway, and this is even true for, I mean, you have n eigenvalues. So let's say that you have n orthonormal functions, u1 to un, and we want to prove that, the sharp constant here would be pi squared over 4, but what they do is to prove 1, which is smaller than pi squared over 4. So how do they prove that? Well, the fact that this paper was overlooked is that this is coming from a different end. I mean, they were interested in the problem of turbulence and a characteristic exponent for turbulence, and there's a connection with the Schrödinger operator, but it's sort of like a different interest. So how do you prove such a thing? Well, you do it in two steps. The first step, consider any function in H1, prove this point-wise estimates on the function. F of x is bounded from x squared, is bounded from above by the product of the L2 norm of f and the L2 norm of f prime. And in fact, you have equality when f of x is just e to the minus x with a cusp here. And how do you prove? Well, there are many ways to prove it. The simplest way I could imagine is you put f squared as the derivative of f squared, and you compute the square here. And you also do it, I mean, you do it from minus infinity to 2x, from x to infinity. You add them, and you're going to have the L2 norm, and then you optimize in alpha, and you have it. So the whole proof is there. Right. And now, just something that people in the realm of orthogonal polynomials use all the time. I have to teach that from time to time. So this is sort of like this called the Christoffel function. So write f of, in terms of this orthogonal family, write f y of x as this sum from y I1 to the n. So this is a function of x which depends parametrically on y. So usually in the books of mathematical method, this is called kxy, and it's used a lot. So anyway, compute now the L2 norm of fxy, and use the fact that the uis are orthonormal, you are going to have that immediately. And if you compute the L2 norm of the derivative of this function with respect to x, then this is not going to be very simple because the derivatives are not going to be orthonormal, so you are going to have a double sum here. And now replace that and that in the first step, which was that. And now set x was just anything here. This is valid for all x. So put x equal y here. And this thing is going to cancel one of the powers. So this is going to disappear. This is going to be 5yy cube. And now integrate. And when you integrate this thing here, you use orthogonality, and that's going to produce the Kronecker's delta, and one of the sums is going to disappear, and then you have that with the one. So, well, this is a simplified version. I mean, in the original paper, it's not that simple, but this is something you can remember forever. I mean, and unfortunately, when you are doing these two steps, in the first step, the function that optimizes this inequality is just e to the minus x. Which, by the way, is sort of like the ground state of the Schrödinger operator with the delta function that you should keep in mind if you want to improve this. And this one, on the other hand, if you want to optimize this quantity, you should obey Walter and use solenoid things, 1 over cos squared. So, so the potential that maximizes this is different, right? It's not the delta function. So that's the problem, and they enter into contradiction, and that's why you don't have the right pi squared over 4. Well, I have tried several different ways of trying to improve this. All of them have failed. But anyway, I'm telling you why it fails. I mean, this is a very nice proof, but it fails in the sense that it doesn't give you the sharp constant. So anyway, to end up, I would like to give you a table with the constants so far. This is sort of like a summary. Well, as I said, the best constant so far was given by Eden Foyas. It was given by 0.3849. I mean, you can compute it precisely. And, I mean, you go back with Foyas. So this was the best constant so far. And it is so far the best constant because they are considering the problem with n. So this is the best constant so far. They were considering the what happens when you have n eigenvalues. Excuse me? Yeah, but if you reduce it, you go back to the inequality. I mean, you can use it modulo the this. So anyway, this is the best constant so far. In the paper of Hundermark, Laptev, and Beidel, they were using trace formulas and all that. They had a worst constant here, 0.429. If we use our geometrical trick, which is valid only when you have n equal 2, because we're using complex variables, then you have a better value, 0.34. And the conjecture value is 0.24. So we are, well, the best bound for two eigenvalues is ours, but the best bound in general is Eden Foyas still, and we're pretty far from 0.2450, which would be the conjecture value. So anyway, I would like to end up there. It's 4:10, so thank you very much.